Recently had an opportunity to check out the Gila Cliff dwellings up in New Mexico. I'm on my way from Sedona to Austin to promote the Quest for Ancient Civilizations conference. It's going to be in the same place they film Austin City Limits. Now, I'm in Austin now, but on the way there, I stopped at a few places to check out the sites, and these cliff dwellings were the most interesting by a country mile. So let's talk about the Gila Cliff dwellings and the Mogollon culture that is said to have made. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to the Dunkin. Come see me in Austin this October 16th through 18th. All right, let's talk about the site. This place was built around 1200 AD, according to the dendrochronology, that's the tree ring dating, in the wood beams that were used for the structure, by the Mogollon people. The Mogollon culture had been living in pit houses, and then they moved to above-ground pueblos. But around 1150, they started moving into the cliffs. And they were not alone. Most Native Americans in the Southwest moved into the cliffs for about 100 to 150 years before finally abandoning the places around 1300. Built of sandstone bricks, wood, and mortar, the Gila Cliff dwellings are 80% original today, they say. And many of the modifications to the site were done to discourage looting and to make it more difficult. I mean, in fact, this place was so heavily looted that by the time they made this a national park, it was a primary concern of archaeologists that they'd lost most of the data of the site already. The site only had about 50 people living there, they say, a small community far out in the desert. Located near the headwater of the Gila River and also near a spring that feeds another river, it gave the occupants a reliable source of fresh water, which obviously is not something easily dismissed in the desert. Now, this made the place pretty much ideal for the occupants, except for it was hard to reach. It was way up in the cliffs and about a mile hike from the visitor center now, and that's a whole lot easier than it would have been back in the day because we got a road that gets to the visitor center. But when you get up there, it becomes very obvious, at least it did to me, that this was set up as a defensible position. That was the primary concern, was the ability to defend this area from warfare. And this isn't the only people, like I said, in the area that popped up into cliffs at that time. But when you take the villages that were much larger, that used to house 100, 200, 300 people, and you split them into about 50 people and shove them into the cliffs, sounds to me like they weren't doing very well in whatever war they were engaged in. And this seems to have been the norm around the Southwest for about 200 years or so, as the move to cliff dwellings was universal in the region. Didn't matter what culture we are talking about, we find them moving to the cliffs around 1150. The sizes of the villages got smaller, the locations much more remote, and the defensibility of those locations was far higher than their previous villages. And we see this here. There's no way to approach the Gila Cliff dwellings without being seen by somebody else, unless you got a helicopter. So well hidden and remote that just finding it would be an issue. And it's also naturally a fortification, a place that one could protect with only a few warriors. And the design seems to incorporate this sort of thinking. The caves and man-made walls offer multiple defensive positions to fall back to, which would allow freedom of movement and strategic decisions to be made in a very small area when the attackers would have no such freedom at all. Even children throwing rocks would be deadly from the heights, allowing anyone in the village to inflict casualties before the invaders could even think about doing so. Now, basically, the Mogollon people turned this area into a castle, and then they left after about 30 years, they say, which to me reinforces the idea that this place was used as a defensive position for warfare primarily. There's three prevailing hypotheses amongst the experts. One is that it was for warfare. One is that they moved to the cliffs because it was hotter then, which it was. And the other one is they moved to the cliffs so they could use the flatlands for farmland. All of these seem far less convincing to me than the idea that it was about war. They went right back to that more comfortable way of life as soon as it was possible. And again, this is ubiquitous across the region. And before we look closer at the structure's details, let's look at the people who made it. The Mogollon culture's origins are a bit of a mystery. Some believe they came from the ancient desert dwellers long before. Others believe they descended from the Cochise culture, a group of people who occupied what is now Mexico. And others believe they're part of a group of migrants who displaced the people when they arrived. And then, of course, there are those who say they've always been there, But, you know, the mystery of their origins doesn't stop us from learning about their culture, their pottery, their architecture, and even some of the religious things we know today. Their style of pit houses are very distinct and well known to those who study the region, as is their pottery. They were foragers and farmers, but their pottery was what helped them trade. And in fact, some people believe that they migrated so much for trading purposes. The pottery is still sought after today, but in their time, it was an important trade gig. And some archaeologists believe that that was basically their entire job, and their pottery was high on the list of things that they would trade to people. Now, they had some unique ways of making pottery, and it showed then, as it does today, in particular, the Mimbres pottery, which comes from the Mimbres branch of the Mogollon culture, is very well known. Pottery was so popular in the region that in more modern times, pot hunting became a very popular family pastime. And no, I don't mean looking for a guy like me at the gas station to find a dime bag. Well, what I'm saying here is that people used to go after church with their kids out in the desert and look for pieces of ancient pottery. So much so that there's not very much of it left. Like I said, this even happened up there at the cliff dwellings. Now, when the people of the Mogollon culture would pass, they would put a bowl over their face, and they would put what's known as a kill hole in this bowl. And this is interesting to me because they're not really sure much about this, but, you know, extrapolating from the Pacific Northwest natives, they would bury their deceased in the canoe they used in life. So it's quite possible that they were using the same bowl that this person used in life. And the kill hole? Well, if these are really valuable trade goods, what better way of making sure they don't dig up your buddy that just passed away than making sure that bowl ain't no good no more? Now, of course, this is just my personal opinion here. Take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, these people, they may or may not have descendants in the region today. The Pueblos claim to be their offspring, but the science is uncertain. DNA testing has not been done, and it's not going to be done in the foreseeable future. You see, Native American tribes have control over the remains of their ancestors due to a law called NAGPRA. And thanks to that law, well, we don't do much DNA testing on Native American Indian remains anymore. Native American Indian, that's the politically correct term. Now, it's possible they died off, perhaps they were wiped out, or perhaps they integrated into other groups, but we do not see evidence for their culture after 1540, and the Apache that now occupy the region are not at all related to the Mogollon people. Now, some believe they're related to the Hopi, to the Acoma, and the Zuni people, as their oral traditions and culture do seem connected. But just like the cliff dwellings that they live in, these people are surrounded by mystery. Now, the cliff dwellings were made a national park in 1907, and that's when the first renovations began, with the intention of securing the site and protecting it from tourists. The roads leading to the site were nearly impassable by most vehicles back then, and the heavy rains the regions get frequently made the roads considerably worse. Now, in the cliff dwellings, there were 46 different rooms occupying that cave system, and if you look at the ceiling, you can see blackening on the main areas and on the different living areas from years of fire and smoke. Now, numerous bodies were found on the site, but almost all of them were stolen and or sold. And now, they're just missing to history now, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say they're on a rich dude's shelf. This is a problem we end up discussing quite frequently on this channel. The things in the early days of archaeology, when the coolest stuff has still just lying around to be taken, well, they took everything. But, of course, this is a story for a different video. Now, one mummy of an infant was found, and this is the only mummy from the site the Smithsonian is still said to have. Of course, it ain't available for display or examination. It's in a pile of human remains somewhere in the Smithsonian that's, you know, written down on paper, but nobody ever gets to look at anymore. Again, this is the kind of crap I have mentioned before on the channel, and it is fairly problematic. See, this happened a lot, as we'll discuss down the road. So basically, the mummified infant known as Zeke back in the day, he's around, totally. I showed you a picture of him from 100 years ago. Good enough, right? The use of ladders to enter the different rooms was standard, and there are a couple of reproduction ladders that are at the site now to allow you to look into the old rooms. Hearths can be seen, and again, the telltale black soot on the stones nearby gives it away. Almost nothing remained on the surface of the site by the later 1800s, and to find artifacts in more modern days, it took a proper excavation. Numerous pottery pieces, feathers, shells, beads, ears of corn, stone tools and weapons, and other objects were found. Now, sadly, the stratigraphy was really disturbed. That's the layers of the dirt, right? It's poorly disturbed by years of looting, but They were able to still determine a few things by using dendrochronology and other methods to date, but they couldn't use stratigraphy to do so. Now, one of the things that they figured out was that the cliff dwellers were in contact with other people in the region. Now, in fact, in the area before the cliff dwellers were there, there were a number of smaller temporary settlements, but nothing like the cliff dwellings. It was like the region was known of, but not occupied for very long times until the war or whatever caused them to move into the hills. Now, many of those sites are still unexcavated today. And it's kind of interesting because you have to wonder what might be sitting there, just a few inches of dirt, or what might have been stolen already. Now, a gigantic boulder is inside of these caves, and it's incorporated into the walls. It wasn't moved far. It looks to have fallen directly from above where it sits, but it does look to have been shifted some. And clearly, these people were resourceful and inventive, as the location shows, and this giant boulder. Now, a small tunnel connects some areas of the cave system to others, but this is off limits to modern visitors. We must stick to the path and not touch anything because, I mean, look, the site's still, like they say, about 80% complete today, and that's really thanks to the efforts of the last 100 years of preservation. Now, you're not allowed to bring food or flavored drinks on the hike as it could attract animals that would then potentially damage the site. Now, as I mentioned, the hike is about a mile, and it's really not for those unsure of their footing. Now, several places will be hard to navigate unless you're feeling spry. And after the 2-hour drive to get there, my old ass was feeling a lot less than spry. But I still managed to make it, so if you don't need crutches, you'll probably do okay, too. It's worth it. You're up there, and it's like you just feel in the place. You're walking through history. There was people there almost 1,000 years ago living their entire lives, and you're standing in their freaking living room. It's pretty cool stuff. There were pictographs on the walls that are now mostly faded. Atlatl pieces were found inside. Atlatls are ancient spear throwers for taking down big game, for those of you who are unaware. In fact, a slab was found in 1968 that appears to have been used long before the cliff dwellings were built, and it seems to have been used to grind grain on. There's another cave on the trail, not elevated like the others, that contains piles of rubble, and it had artifacts in it that implied some older use of the site as well. This area seems to have been used off and on by people before the Mogollon culture built these cliff dwellings there. And we can't say for certain how often or how regularly they used it, but we can say that there are some more artifacts most likely at the site. There's parts they haven't excavated yet. The site is not fully excavated. And to be clear, this is not completely uncommon. Most sites don't get fully excavated. But there are some signs of a little bit of a shadiness going on here, and well, let's get into that side of it. Now, first of all, we have the National Register of Historic Places inventory form. Now, it's so heavily redacted, you'd think it came from a federal document on an island where billionaires hang out. Redactions can be common on these forms, but the reason that they tell you that they're doing redactions is to protect the sites, to protect the artifacts, to make sure the public doesn't know where to go turn a spade and steal stuff. That makes sense. But then you have to wonder why the hell that same piece of paper has the following quote. While most of the site has been excavated, unexcavated, intact deposits are believed to still exist from the Puebloan occupation in Cave 2 and isolated deposits of possibly earlier material in Cave 5. So if the intention is to hide the location of artifacts from people who would go dig them up, why the hell are they telling me where to go dig them up? That seems really weird, doesn't it? Honestly, it looks to me more like they're facilitating hiding of specific artifacts and maybe even individuals that were involved. Very rarely is a location hidden, usually a person or a thing. For example, check out these following two sections. Now, why are there no artifacts listed here, but the sites that they found them are still listed? See, this is a little catalog number to tell you where the site is, and that's there. What they found there isn't listed. And, you know, looting isn't something that only non-archaeologists do. I mean, archaeologists are people, too. But we do have one thing that we have to consider when we're looking at it that could be even more nefarious. Now, less than 450 miles away is the place where in 1909, G.E. Kincaid claimed to have discovered all manner of Egyptian artifacts and iconography in a cliff dwelling high above the river. Now, of course, this has been dismissed, but you cannot visit the site today, which, of course, makes the story a whole lot harder to ignore. You know, cover-ups aren't my favorite thing to cover because, by their very nature, they're fucking hard to investigate. But in situations like this, just like the redactions on the Island Boys Island, it gets kind of difficult to not say something fishy's going on here. There's no reason for these redactions, but there they are, and there's a ton of them. Now, obviously, there were artifacts in the Gila cliff dwellings that were stolen for material gain. History says basically as much. But perhaps there were some finds in later years that were stolen and sold. Now, this seems pretty likely to me, and if there was evidence of old and new world contact happening before history accepts that it happened, this would be extremely likely, because invariably, when you see these sorts of things that are anomalous, that changes the timeline, that just look weird, you get knee-jerk reactions, and you're not allowed to look at them a second time. Whether it was an arrowhead from the Salutrian culture found in the southern United States, or Egyptian artifacts found in a cave over the Colorado River, or coke in Egyptian mummies, or a battery in Iraq 1,500 years ago, the evidence always vanishes. Mark my words, the next time the Antikythera mechanism has its security load, that thing's going to disappear too. This is common. If it's cool, it's unique, it's out of place, it disappears. And as I've said before, fast forward 100 years and things like the Baghdad Battery that nobody will have seen for 100 years except the rich dude who had it stolen, most people are going to be like, oh, that was just a bunch of crap. Just like we dismissed so many things from 100 years ago, like the giant bones said to be found in Native American mounds. Anyway, Kincaid's Egyptian cave is a lot harder for me to accept on its face than the idea that archaeologists stole some artifacts and sold them for personal gain. Now, whether or not these artifacts, you know, had anything to do with contact between the old world and the new, or what they had to do with exactly, that's all up for speculation. But what we can say is the cooler and more unique and more groundbreaking they are, the more desirable, the more money they'd be worth. So you don't need a top-down conspiracy to understand why an archaeologist would sell something that would prove that Egyptians were in the southwest desert of the United States. Look at me speak the English. At any rate, it's a lot to contemplate there. I don't really know for sure what to say, but I know one thing. That paper, that registry paper, had got some damn problems going on there, and somebody made some money. I could hang my hat on that, except I don't wear hats, as you can tell by the bald spot. Anyway, check me out here at the ACL Live. That's the place they do the Austin City Limits, October 16th through 18th. There's going to be a whole bunch of people there. We're going to have some comedians and stuff. It's going to be tremendous. It's going to be hilarious, and it's going to be fun. I like to hang out with you guys when in the real world when we all get together and sit down and have a beer and listen to your theories and tell you why I don't agree with them. Anyway, love you guys to death. Thanks so much. There's buttons down below. Click on them and support the channel, or just, you know, tell me what a piece of crap I am, how I look like a homeless guy. Have a good day, and I hope to see you next time.